Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Now I have to look up the date because I'm so addled. It's Thursday, July 18th, 2019. I am the addled John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism. From a conservative perspective, we invite you to join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
So I just want to make a point at the top that we've been having some technical difficulties connecting to Christine on remote. And so there may be a point at which we will have to sort of end the connection and Christine will drop out. If that happens, I will let you know. Otherwise, we'll go on as planned. And we have no plan. We have no plan for the show. So we can do the Elvis Costello concert thing and spin a wheel and pick a topic. You know how Elvis Costello would put, I shouldn't mention Elvis Costello because he's a supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So the hell with him. But he did have a concert thing where he had like a Wheel of Fortune thing and he would spin it and the song would come up and then they would play the song. So we could do the impeachment thing. We could do Send Her Back. We could talk about the Apollo space mission. We could talk about Stranger Things 3. We could talk about, what else do we have to talk about?
Well, there's a through line through all of them.
Right? Yeah, which is woke,
right.
Commie bastards.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that it? So I do have a column today in the New York Post about Stranger Things 3. If you haven't watched Stranger Things on Netflix.
We're saving it.
Okay, I'm not gonna spoil it, except to say that the third season of Stranger Things, which will make no sense to you if you haven't seen the first two, so talking about this requires like a 17-hour prelude until you can get to the point at which you'll understand what I'm talking about. But so the villain of Stranger Things 3, which is Stranger Things is set in the 1980s in a small town in Indiana. Is the Soviet Union, and sort of unapologetically, very plainly, blatantly, you know, there's like an evil, there's Soviet assassins, there are Soviet plots, there the hollowing out of the American small town by the construction of shopping malls, one of the great issues of the last 35 years on the left, Soviet plot, according to Stranger Things 3. And my piece is about how a bunch of moron liberal gatekeepers in the conventional press are tut-tutting and tisking and waving their fingers at the jingoism of Stranger Things 3 and the appeals to patriotism in it. Now, Stranger Things is a put-on. You have no idea whether the makers share this ideology or not. The first season had the U.S. government as the enemy, so take it as it comes. It's sort of silly, but of course, in the Trump era, and with Trump now making an explicit appeal to a certain type of nationalist patriotism, of course, now patriotism, people aren't going to say he's the wrong kind of patriot. They're just going to start trashing patriotism, right? I remember when Michelle Obama and Barack Obama gave their speeches at the 2016 convention. And I said, this is amazing because the arrival of Donald Trump has now occasioned an explosion of patriotism on the part of left-wing Democrats who are suddenly saying, America's what he says, America's so terrible. Oh, yeah, America's the greatest country on earth. You know, this is from Michelle Obama, who, of course, famously said that she had never been proud of her country until her husband, you know, secured the Democratic nomination for president, which she has now rescinded, by the way. In an interview with Gayle King last week, she said she's no longer proud of America. That pride, of course, being conditional, as we know.
2009 to 2017.
Right. Okay. So anyway, so the through line in the Elvis Costello BDS Wheel of Fortune is, is this the fight for 2020? Is it going to be, you know, America's good, and if you don't like it, get the hell out of here. From the guy who said that America was awash in carnage just 3 years ago. I mean, who knew carnage was so easily ended and that the glorious times that we now live in were so easily summoned?
Yeah, I mean, that makes it a little more anodyne, I think, than it actually is. I mean, it's really incredibly distasteful. Very deleterious to the social fabric.
Okay, you're talking about Trump's response to the squad and
the squad, the Democrats and now it has become a rallying cry, literally, where we had an entire arena full of people talking about essentially the forced deportation of an American citizen they don't like. I mean, that stuff is ugly. It's dangerous. It's no joke. And I think everybody is sort of tisking it and waving it off, because to confront what it actually means would be to confront a whole lot of demons that have overtaken this party.
You know, there, not to take this overly seriously, there have been forced deportations of Americans we don't like. Mafia people who got U.S. citizenship and had their citizenship rescinded, which apparently is something that can happen.
You can. And I saw a lot of people entertaining the prospect of revoking her citizenship based on immigration fraud claims that have, none of them have been even remotely demonstrated to any satisfaction, but are in the ether.
But shouldn't we say that this is not actually what Trump, I mean, what Trump has been saying is, if you don't like it, you can leave. You can come back, but you can leave.
That's not what he said
last
night.
That's not what he said last night.
That's not what he's saying, and that's not what he did last night. He stood there.
And it's not really what he said on Sunday.
Pursed lips, with one hand in his shirt, overlooking this crowd, whipped up into a lizard brain frenzy, and enjoying every minute of it.
Well, that's all true at the same time.
He didn't just say you could leave and then come. He did say leave, and then when you come back, you'll see you'll be chastened or something like that. But he did say, he did repeat the idea that they could get the hell out of here. Now, we talked about this on Monday, and, you know, the whole point is that saying, you know, get out of my, you know, get out of here if you hate America is like an old trope. I think there is a weird thing going on, Christine. I'm wondering if you saw this too or thought this too, which is there's this, this is very painful for African Americans to be told to go back where you come from. But that was never the saying go back where you came from was always something aimed at relatively recent immigrants. It was, yeah, you people, you Jewish communists, you don't like this country so much, go back where you came from. If you're an Italian or an Irish person who is, you're Sacco and Vanzetti, go back where you came from if you hate this country so much.
No, I think that's...
yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, I think that's right. I think it's also part of a broader... There's always been this... I mean, you can call it jingoistic or nativistic in its most extreme expressions, which I think it sometimes is. It's the bumper sticker feeling of love it or leave it, right? That used to be seen on bumper stickers all over. And that was some, it's slightly different than saying go back to where you came from. But it's a kind of, nevertheless, a sort of chauvinistic sense of American nationalism. I mean, it does that plus Stranger Things critics make me long for the moral clarity of the Red Dawn era, you know, as a Cold War kid. But I do, you know, I think Noah's right in that we need to look at this as conservatives, especially more broadly. You know, we just had this big meeting here in Washington of sort of conservatives trying to rebrand nationalism. They met at the Ritz-Carlton, you know, to discuss this and to try to kind of rehab a form of nationalism that isn't exactly Trump's speed, but is meant to be helpful, I think, to his reelection chances. And that should be worrisome to principled conservatives, because a lot of what went on at that conference and a lot of the way that Trump is behaving now are not what conservative principles used to be about when it comes to patriotism and pride in one's country.
Well, I did not attend the National Conservatism Conference, which featured several former contributors to commentary. I was struck in reading it how it had this slightly stagey aspect to it, which is, look, Trump's here and Trump's going to go, and there needs to be an intellectual understanding of what Trump is and to build on the electoral coalition and all of that. But they can't really say what it is. I mean, except in the most extreme version, this kind of rejection of the Enlightenment, you know, or of the of classical liberalism. That is one of the organizers, Yoram Hazony. One of his main themes is that everything seemed to have gone wrong in around 1687 with John Locke, and John Locke is some kind of a barbaric pre-Marx monster. But that is a quixotic and weird way to build a contemporary political movement, right? So what you have is Tucker Carlson saying that Elizabeth Warren's book on how families have to have two incomes to survive is the greatest work of conservative thinking of the last 25 years. So if what we're going to have is some bizarre blend of Trump and Warren as the intellectual guideposts of the 21st century, that will be quite a trick.
That's why this is a fruitless enterprise, and it's all solipsistic. The people who try to impose some sort of an ideological consistency on Trump veer from traditionalism to neoconservatism to progressivism to nationalism. It's all an exercise in it's onanism, really, because Trump doesn't want to do any of this. Trumpism is what we saw on that stage. Trumpism is whipping up a crowd into whatever frenzy he can to advance whatever political interest he has in the moment to self-satisfy and self-soothe. And that is Trumpism. And that's where, and by the way, that's where most of his true fans who really get him are absolutely on board with that, because they don't care about any of this ideology either. They want to own the libs. It's a disposition. It's fleeting, and it's situational, and it doesn't really have any consistency to it. And they're the ones who get Trump, not Tucker Carlson.
See, I agree that trying to create an intellectual ideological architecture for Trumpism as a positive thing is a fool's errand, and he himself will make it impossible for anybody to do it because there is such inconsistency. However, I don't think as a negative force, this is what we were talking about just before the show, that you cannot say that there is Trumpism as a negative force. And the way I would frame it, or Abe can probably do sort of explain this better than I can, is that he is there to stop them. And that this is pretty much what he apparently is going to run on in 2020. It's not that he's there to build a new future, though, you know, he'll help. He's making America great again, whatever. But then, in fact, what he is promising is, I will keep those people from getting into power, becoming socialists, taking your livelihoods, and, you know, turning America into a post-sovereign.
Eliminating borders.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So can you?
No, I think that's true. I think there is some content to Trumpism on the negative side, but I don't think it's. I think the idea is, okay, so instead of sort of tiptoeing around what we're facing in wokeness and ultra progressivism, he sort of goes at it in a very sloppy, reckless way. But there's a kind of simple, what the hell are we talking about here kind of aspect to his response. Like, you know, if these people are going to go around saying they hate that the country is cruel, is racist, is warmongering, then
all the stuff we're saying we're going to call 2016.
Well, that's the problem, right? That's what he was saying in 2016.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't saying it was cruel and racist.
He was saying it was cruel, not racist.
He was saying, well, it was racist, reverse racist.
Right, in the sense that, yeah, it's the
anti-white.
Sure.
Effectively.
Well, and this is where the squad's rhetoric plays into his re-election campaign message inadvertently brilliantly, right? I mean, he can say, look, everything I told you about how they think about white people is true. In fact, they won't even let, you know, Ayanna Pressley's statement about, you know, we don't want brown voices have to, you know, they have to say the right thing. They have to say what we believe. This idea of ideological conformity being linked to racial identity, that was kind of the sub-theme of Trumpism in 2016, which of course everyone was aghast about, but that's exactly what the more progressive wing of the Democratic squad is itself arguing.
Yeah, it's almost like they're two sides of the same coin.
But that's the thing. The problem with identity politics, we said this in 2016, the problem with identity politics is if you divide the country by race and you divide the country by ethnicity, white people make up the largest number of people in the United States. If that is how you're going to judge, that's how you're going to tell people they should vote, that they should vote on color, that they should vote on background, that they should vote on all of that, you are consigning yourself to a permanent minority status in the United States in its political life. That is something that is being imposed on America by the left, has been a 40-year project of the left without ever thinking of what the blowback might be. People who, like us, who are constantly saying, don't count by race, count, as Glenn Lowry, who then changed his mind on some of this, said, you count one by one from the inside out. Individuals are what matter, not group. Individuals are what matter, not your race, not your religion, not anything like that. As an individual, you have individual rights. That is, the country is made up of 330 million individuals. Well, that argument was kind of lost in the onrush of identity politics, and then it was used as a cudgel against the very people who thought this was their path to power.
Can I ask a sort of question of everyone here? Do you think that the Trump supporters' response to the Squad is animated by a distaste for what they say and the policies they promote more than the fact that the Squad is not white?
You mean the people in that room? Specifically,
you mean in the rally?
Generally. I mean, what is the?
No, I think the people in that room were saying what Trump said verbatim,
right?
Because
so
Trump
were just
said it,
parroting him, right?
Right.
Which is the problem?
Okay, we don't like them because of their policies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if they're saying that their policies are unquestionably connected to their identities, what is one supposed to do with that?
So a progressive,
we're supposed to defend their John Mill liberal one by one from the inside out. We're against themselves, against Ayanna Pressley saying I'm only interested in black voices, black right. faces that speak in black voices.
Okay, so this is all a construct in their heads, but progressives who are committed to this way of thinking, this worldview, essentially, believe that they are responding to identity politics. That identity politics has been the zeitgeist of this country from day one. We mocked it briefly about the New York Times and the Washington Post having this woke-off reimagining of the space program now as this example of how
white supremacy.
White and male supremacy
white
and how
patriarchy.
We have to really rethink it, and how the Soviet Union really got it right by putting Asian and black people in orbit before the United States. I mean, that's a real thing that's going on in this very isolated fringe in which the only people who agree with each other talk to each other. But they believe that these institutions are shot through with white supremacy. They always have been. And to the extent that they are practicing identity politics now, it is leveling the playing field and meeting fire with fire.
Right. But that doesn't answer the central political problem that they have placed in themselves.
Absolutely. No. It is a construct.
If you count by race, whites win. So you shouldn't count by race if you want minority rights.
But they don't
and minority
see it that way. Briefly, they don't yes.
see it that way, but they see that as the constant.
And to the extent that they ever fight back against it and succeed, it is because of identity politics. To say that is just the constant way of things, whites uniting together to tamp down the aspirations of minorities and women and what have you.
And it won't be true forever. This will become a majority-minority country in our children's lifetimes, right? I mean, this is going to be – it's not true demographically, and that actually was a problem that the Republican Party, when George W. Bush was running, was very concerned about, and that's why we got compassionate conservatism. and I think that – you know, the Republican Party's future – it rests on reaching beyond white voters if you look at the demographics. But which is to say that, not, I mean, if you look at, for example, among Hispanic voters, they don't all lean progressive left. They're a very diverse group of political views, as it should be, which goes to your individualism point. But I do think that we shouldn't discount what a lot of the progressive message, especially among this young Squad members, is to say, look, we are the future, kind of to insist that this is right. the way we're going to do things. We're the future demographically, and we're the future of politics in this country.
Right,
that scares people.
Right. But there was a terrible miscalculation. You know, this is a subject Tom Edsel of the Fringe New York Times has been writing extremely well about, which is there was a miscalculation in 2016. There was this idea that, you know, the future was now, that the minority voter was going to be a much more powerful force in 2016 than the minority voter turned out to be, because it turned out they were undercounting the number of white working class voters, and that the whites did not make up 72% of the electorate, but 74% of the electorate. And that 2% is the 2% that won Trump the election, right? So in some fashion or other. So the one of the problems with this, eventually we will be a majority-minority country, and so we better act now, is like all such forward-thinking, it's like the, we better deal with the entitlements crisis now, because in 2032, the federal government will be spending 100% of its budget on healthcare, right? But it's not 2032, and it's like saying to people, you know, you better invest your money, take your money and put it in a bank account, because eventually there'll be a recession, right? But as long as there's not a recession, you're going to miss out on the stock market surge. The idea that long-term thinking, you know, takes the place of short-term thinking is belied by the structure not only of our brains but also of our politics, which is there, which there is an election every 2 years.
It's the famous "That's a problem for future Homer" from The Simpsons. That's the
That's right, exactly, exactly. So, but to get back to the wheel and the whole thing of what where of everything connecting to everything else. Trump is being given a gift. Clearly, I think everybody who isn't, you know, just sort of like a cheerleader for the Democrats understands that the existence of the squad is a gift to Trump politically. It gives him a foil. It gives him something to fight against until, remember, we have like 9 months until there's going to be a Democratic nominee. He's got somebody to fight against every day who isn't just Pelosi. And he could then use a Democrat. He can use Pelosi as a foil against them, force, you know, and all of that. So they're a gift to him. And is that? I mean, can it be this easy? Can it be this easy that Trump is going to be able to ride this, you know, substitute Hillary? So it's not Hillary, right? It's not she's old and crooked. It's that she's young and a communist. And if you let these young whippersnappers take this country over, they're gonna make it a communist country that hates Israel and all of that. Christine.
Well, I mean, I think that you're right that they provide a perfect foil, but I don't know how much the average voter is getting into the weeds on the squad. I think, you know, the wonderful David Beiler, my former colleague at the Weekly Standard, who's now at the Washington Post, did a little bit of deep diving into some of the polls that have come out about the unpopularity of the squad. And he raised some questions about their methodology and how far reaching their conclusions are. I'm not sure the average American can't name who's on the Supreme Court or, you know, more than one member of the president's cabinet. I'm not clear that they are, you know, zooming in on the squad and what the name recognition is beyond kind of people who are political junkies. That said, Trump is doing that work by saying these people, but just saying the word socialist, I think as long as he keeps that the vague menace, in a strange way, that's going to be much more powerful than getting into the details of what the squad's policy platform is going to be.
Well, okay, so next week, here's what I mean by the gift. So next week, Ilhan Omar, representative from Minnesota, as her first major act as a legislator, is going to introduce or push a resolution that is an implicit attack on the effort to contain the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which, of course, seeks to impose these things on Israel for its supposedly monstrous treatment of the Palestinians. 27 states have passed legislation banning organizations that support BDS or vote for BDS from getting state funds and various other things. So this resolution, which is toothless, just a resolution, will say that we affirm the right of people to boycott and all of that. There's no reason to pass such a resolution simply as a matter of course, because the only movement that's involved in either boycotting or not boycotting is BDS. So here's my question. Who does Ilhan Omar work for? I don't mean that she works for the Palestinians. I mean, is she working for the Trump campaign? Who does this help? This country supports Israel against the Palestinians when you ask who they have favorable views of by something like 50 to 7. 50 to 8, nobody in the United States, people are sympathetic toward the Palestinians. Nobody in this country except the far left is affirmatively, positively a supporter of the Palestinians. Nobody. It's the only country in the world of which this is true, but it is true of the United States.
She's doing it because she, like the rest of the members of the squad, they think they're leading a revolution. I mean, it's not even a political calculation.
And the target of this is not Republicans or Israel or the states that block boycott resolutions. It's her fellow Democrats. She's trying to get them on the record with where they stand on Israel and Palestine and trying to push them in the direction of the grassroots, which is viciously, vehemently anti-Israel.
But that's self-defeating because
not in our minds, in the Tea Party's minds. This is how the Tea Party operated. They went on suicide runs in order to impose ideological homogeneity on the conference.
The Tea Party never. I will say this: the Tea Party did politically ruinous things like push for government shutdowns and opposing any effort to end the government shutdowns. Nobody supported an effort to boycott a friend of the United States, that friend being viewed favorably by a majority of people. And at a moment when they have a real sense that maybe they have this desideratum in their grasp that they can push the Democratic Party away from Israel affirmatively, something like this will actually backfire. Will not help. They are not going to get votes for this.
That's not how the Tea Party types saw shutdowns. They saw shutdowns as being an exercise in getting their message out and making this case to the American people that would ultimately result in some sort of epiphany on the part of the Republican establishment because their voters would go with them. It was all this Rube Goldberg idea of how politics would play out, but they had a logic to it.
But this is spectacularly arrogant on her part, and this is the question of whether what their political judgment is and whether they know what they're doing and all of that, because she, 3 months before she was elected, said she was opposed to BDS. She had a meeting with Jewish leaders in the Twin Cities, the ancestral home of my mother, and she said, I do not support BDS. And the first thing she does is a resolution in support of BDS. You think politicians don't do stuff like that. That is the easiest way to get themselves to be, you know, destroyed. And or, by the way, she also has another thing coming, which is there will be a redistricting after 2020. Let's say she can't lose next year because unless, you know, there's some kind of successful primary challenge or something, which is doubtful. But everybody in Minnesota, if she continues on like this, is going to want to redistrict her out of existence.
So in response to this, I think the answer is yes. The squad will continue to try to make it as easy as possible for Trump to win with the media's help. The media is going to be backing them up every step of the way. It's gonna fall to whoever the Democratic nominee is to try with all their might to distance themselves from this. And that's going to create a whole new set of problems because it's going to create a fractured Democratic Party, which triggers a whole different set of weaknesses.
And this is another reason why this is the Tea Party Redux, because these four have demonstrated that the locus of power in this country's politics on the left is not in Nancy Pelosi's hands anymore. It is in the press, just as the Tea Party understood that it was Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity who controlled the caucus. The conference, rather. These people understand that you can't redistrict me out of my district because I'll go to the grassroots and I will exert the kind of pressure on you that you cannot withstand.
Yeah, well, in Minnesota, the grassroots is going right, not left, by the way. But
Minnesota's
going. It's a national issue. It has nothing to do with
Minnesota. Okay, anyway, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, we were talking on Monday's podcast about whether Biden and others will have a sister soldier moment. Maybe the squad will have to, he'll have to have a squad moment. I mean, as he gets closer to the nomination, especially if he's getting pummeled by identity politics issues in the next debate and race issues, he might have to take that stand. Honestly, I think it would help him with the swath of moderate Democrats and undecided voters who are going to decide this next election. But who knows? We'll see if he can do it.
You know, I have such pop culture detritus in my head that all I can think of is the scene at the end of Singing in the Rain when Lena Lamont, horribly voiced but beautiful silent film actress who's being dubbed by Debbie Reynolds, says to the studio head something like, I can sue, she's going to have to be my voice forever, you can never give her a part, And, you know, I'm going to be making some changes around here. And the studio head says, oh, yeah, really? So this is now Lena Lamont Pictures. And she's like, yeah. And then they all get together. And while she's lip syncing the song behind the stage, they lift up the curtain to reveal that Debbie Reynolds is singing behind her. Right. So this is sort of like AOC and these four, like they're four out of 40 people who won this year. They represent, you know, districts that are not representative of the United States, and they're trying to run their party. And if Pelosi or Biden or whatever doesn't get behind stage and pull up the curtain to show that they had their pipsqueaks who have no real power except this kind of reflected Plato's cave power from the media and everything like that, you know, they will have it, because power is just perception, right? I mean, unless you actually have a weapon to shoot somebody dead with, you know? So, yes, I've now pulled the Lena Lamont card. It's my 58 years have I ever made a political analogy
and
to
it'll
sing
be
into 58 the
more until we get around to
oh,
that.
Oh, it was so good, though. Anyway, let me just stop here and tell you people. Tell you people out there in our listening audience that you should consider NetSuite, our advertiser, because if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders in HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, at netsuite.com/commentary. That's netsuite.com/commentary to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/commentary. Okay, so as I was reading, I see Abe and Noah are fiendishly looking at Twitter to see if there's anything for them to talk about. So what did you see? Talk about something.
Well, it's just...
The spinning wheel is now blank. So
it's the stupidest thing on earth, but it is the reimagining of the moon landing as insufficiently woke that has really captured my attention. It is indicative of a mania that has overtaken American media... In particular, I mean, these people actually think that Americans are starved for a scolding lecture about why the greatest engineering achievement in human history was tainted by its lack of ethnic and gender diversity. They really think that. Well, is there anybody around to say, maybe not?
Well, that's the best part of one of the stories. They framed it as, you know, it was a sexist enterprise, and until we face it, we'll never get past it. No one wants to get past it. It's like the most celebrated thing. It's universally adored in this country.
And the best
to work through our feelings.
It's framed as an obstacle to reigniting our human exploration of the solar system, as though you can't actually connect the two. So they just sort of say it. It won't be challenged.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say that there was this lovely moment on the Mall this week here in D.C., which lately has seemed to be such a scene of, you know, acrimony when any you know, sort of from the Covington kids thing and then Trump's 4th of July stuff. But this was a really wonderful moment where they did a hologram projection on the Washington Monument of the launch of the Saturn V rocket. And it was amazing to see there was diversity of people watching it, men, women, you know, girls and boys. And all I could think was, someone's going to complain that it was too phallic, right? Like that imagery was somehow
oppressing
women.
Well, it was projected on the Washington Monument. I don't know how you make it more phallic than the Washington Monument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it really actually was a lovely moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the interesting thing about the nostalgia for Apollo 11 as the one person here who was conscious when all this was going on is that after Apollo 11, the American support for the space program dried up instantly, if you go to the Kennedy Space Center, which is one of the great places to visit in the United States, we did it as a family when we were in Orlando going to Disney World, and it's a 50-mile drive from Disney World. So if you ever go, give yourself an extra day and go to the Kennedy Space Center, because when you go there, you can see these two rockets that were not fired because they canceled the space program after, I think, Apollo 17. And Apollo 18 was kind of ready to go. I mean, they had built the rockets that Apollo 18 were going to fire Apollo 18 into space, and they were not used. And so they hang in this hangar at the Kennedy Space Center, and you have never seen anything like this. You walk under it. It is 250 feet long. It is a single piece of aluminum construction. It is 2.5 football fields long. And you think, my God, like, look at what we could do. Now, obviously, what's most amazing about our era is that things are incredibly small, right? That the iPhone has more computing power than the entire space program ever did, your individual iPhone. But nonetheless, that, you know, that there was this sort of landmark human achievement, and we just pissed it all away.
Well,
but for good reason, some way, because all it was about getting to the moon. That was what Kennedy said.
But see, and this is why the achievement and the celebration of the achievement sticks in the craw of the wokesters, is that it's so thoroughly linked to the Cold War. It's about beating the Russians.
Right, it was about beating the Russians.
But the Russians beat us in diversity in space.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they were really great. So the Russians, under the
friendly auspices of Brezhnev and Khrushchev.
Yes, but PETA doesn't like how many animals they killed while getting to that diverse human people in orbit.
There you go.
They killed a lot of dogs, had to die.
Right. But it was about the Cold War, and yet it wasn't about the Cold War. It was about what human beings could do if they set their minds to it. That was the amazing thing, is that Kennedy said in 8 years we will go to the, you know, we will go to the moon by the end of this decade. And we did. We couldn't build the goddamn World Trade Center. It took us 15 years to finish the goddamn World Trade Center building after the World Trade Center came down. Because, you know, that's what the country is like now. Now,
there's
it was
also
a monument to waste. It was ridiculously expensive. And it had no purpose except for the purpose that all space exploration has, which we have which Noah writes very eloquently about in the June issue of Commentary in his review of Robert Zubrin's book called The Case for Space, which is, it's about that we should explore, that we should understand the universe, that we should, our knowledge should get greater, and that the storehouse of human industry should be, and that we should then be able to use our knowledge to expand ourselves beyond the Earth.
Well, also that there is commercial value to it. There was a lot of commercial value that was generated by the space program and innovation.
Velcro.
Among other things.
Velcro is good.
Very important. But what I think, we, you know, underlying all this perhaps, is a bit of existential dread about the onset of a new era of space exploration, which has begun in earnest, which is commercial, private, and profit-based. And there is profit to be had in the exploration of the solar system, which I wrote about in that article. And it's several generations out. But it is beginning, and this is one of the reasons why we haven't returned to space in real earnest, is because we've been doing it by committee. We've been dedicated to constituency maintenance and vendor maintenance in the form of NASA, and we lack competition in the form of a sort of international peer who is racing us to the moon, which is the only reason why we're contemplating going back to the moon, is because we have another peer now who is competing us in that environment. And competition is what will get
us China.
Back. Competition is what will get us back into space. And when you see space TV and like sci-fi stuff, it's always international consortiums and global comedy that is sending this Benetton ad into orbit. That's not how it's going to happen.
Right.
It's going to happen because we're racing some other peer competitor towards a profit motive.
But, and this is what's important, this is why the space program collapsed. I mean, it didn't quite collapse because we were still sending up the space shuttle and stuff like that, but it mostly collapsed because it was a publicly paid for program, and people with some merit said, like, we're in recession, things are terrible, we have a war going on, and we're spending, you know, that, you know, we've got inflation going crazy, and we're spending, you know, the equivalent of $1 trillion a year or something like that on this program. This is crazy. So the profit motive, of course, vitiates all that, because it's, and that's where you get the weirdness. The weirdness is suddenly everybody who's like, this is nonsense, we should be spending on social programs, is going to be like, this is terrible, space is being commercialized. Like, you can't win with them. There's no winning.
There's a pop cult. There's already a developing pop culture critique of that potential corporate future, right? There was the movie Passengers that came out some years ago. I don't think it did very well at the box office, with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt, where they're on this huge corporate 90 plus year journey into deep space, where there's a colonization, but it's all corporate, it's all privatized, and the implicit, you know, that they're basically made to seem, you know, Chris Pratt is the working class guy who's going to, you know, live on the colony forever, and he's basically in a form of indentured servitude to this huge corporation, and it's all about the breakdown of the corporation's supposedly perfect, you know, way of getting them into space, and there's a fairly harsh critique of this idea of, you know, privatizing space. So you're right that they can't win. On the other hand, you know, we're in partnership now with corporations, right? SpaceX, I mean, the private rockets are sending, you know, publicly funded space research probes and stuff for us into space. So we're already kind of merging the two. But I'm with Noah that there's a purpose to exploration for its own sake, and we've lost sight of that and of the truly awe-inspiring effort it takes to do that in our era of, you know, amazing supercomputers and iPhones.
The comedy is, of course, that what we also heard a couple of weeks ago, that Richard Branson's space mission is now theoretically about to start selling private seats on space trips, right, for $250,000 a pop. And then, of course, we have the top 0.1% and more income inequality. This is so unfair, as opposed to, like, people are going to spend $250,000 with a relatively non-zero possibility that they will blow up. Now, I mean, this is not a joke. Like, you know, they will be examples of explorers of the old sort, which is to say, you got no reason to assume that you will return home safely. I mean, relatively, it's not the way it was in the 1960s when every other, you know, mission blew up. But you could blow up. I mean, the shuttle blew up twice, you know.
In our lifetime.
And now we're supposed to object. No one is going to do this, like, as a dilettante, is what I'm saying, you know? And a lot of people who do this kind of exploration, even the people who, like, seem ridiculous and crazy to us, like the people who are trying to climb Mount Everest, and cost tens of thousands of dollars to do that stuff.
In our lifetimes, the private space exploration and travel, what's going to happen in space over the course of our lifetimes is two things. One, we're going to develop something reliable, but nevertheless out of the reach of most normal people, space travel from one side of the planet to the other, so you can get from Sydney to New York in an hour, essentially. And it'll cost you tens of thousands of dollars to do it, but it'll become more reliable. After that, you'll have something like space tourism, and people are already testing modules in orbit, so that you'll have something that looks like a space hotel. This is going to really exacerbate class tensions. And also, we're going to start launching weaponized space platforms. Not just kill vehicles, not just something that can ram into something else, but space fighter vehicles to anti-satellite weaponry, because every nation is invested in anti-satellite weaponry, and just sending a projectile into another projectile isn't going to get the job done. So the anxiety over what's happening in space among the left is going to peak in the next decade, decades.
You're making me anxious. I mean, I'm almost 60, so, you know, maybe this will pass to my children.
I mean, that's the stepping stone to
have to live through
actual.
You know, I had
value
to live through the Cold War. They can live through the weaponized space platform. That's how I look at it. Like, I don't need that. you know, in my golden years when I'm sitting in Florida thinking about how they're about to knock out the satellite that is, you know, allowing me to surf the internet in 2038 or whenever the hell it'll be. Well, you know, all that said, the Apollo 11, the achievement of the Apollo missions was a kind of thing that used to be considered was a fundamentally liberal expression of optimism in the sense that it was, we're going to take the federal government, we're going to spend a crap load of money with no care about where what getting it back or any sense of fiscal responsibility whatsoever, and we're going to do it, and that's going to prove how great we are because we did it top down, ordered by the president through a government agency, and all of that. That was liberal optimism. That was like Star Trek, 5-year mission, you know, United Federation of Planets, everything is, what you know, this is an optimistic vision of the future, an optimistic thing of what government can do. And what's interesting to me is that Democrats and liberals are still like incredibly supportive of and desirous of the use of and obsessed with the idea that government must run everything. But they have no optimism about the success of government action. And without that optimism, I don't know how they sell it beyond the idea that they're just going to redistribute things because that's fair.
Well, because the optimism conflicts with the far left message that sort of, you know, you have to knock America at every turn. I mean, that's, you know, what's behind this sort of semi-attack on our space accomplishments here is that you think America did something great here, think again.
Right, but it's not just that. I think actually the feeling that government action does not produce the results you want is the real world is the painful learned experience of the Great Society and its aftermath that the effort to eradicate poverty didn't work exactly. I mean, there was poverty as it was once understood does barely exist in the United States, but it was not eradicated by government, and government can't do all these great things, and according to their own terms, all government can do is either get waylaid or corrupted, or it can just take money from this guy and give it to that guy, and that's the only thing it can do successfully. So is not by the way that there's all that much optimism in Trumpism either, except that, you know, the economy is so good, he's so great that everything is great. Because of course, once he's out, then everything will be terrible because he's not doing it.
Yeah, no, there's no. I mean, even from the traditionalist perspective and the progressive perspective, when they try to define what Trumpism is, you know, he's a bulwark against cultural change. He's making things fairer by embracing the sort of redistributionist philosophy. It's all a declinist philosophy, and the idea that he is, you know, a bulwark against something that is basically unstoppable, and we can only suppress the tide. That the pie is shrinking and it needs to be distributed evenly. That is the intellectual case. The true elements of Trumpism that are evident in that arena yesterday and that are evident in the social media summit, that's very positive because they don't have a philosophy. It is only insofar as Donald Trump is doing well that they believe themselves to be doing well. And as long as Trump says he's doing well, they're doing well.
But again,
it's not an intellectual exercise.
Let me just put this in. Oh, go ahead, Christine. Sorry.
I was just going to say there's also this secondary issue of and this involves some soul searching on the part of conservatives that we are not want to do. And that's that, you know, we become so cynical that the kind of Reagan-style optimism of yesteryear, whose fumes we've all been running on for quite a while, is that even possible in the political landscape these days? That's as much a challenge for conservatism now, post-Trump, as it is currently for the Democrats.
Right.
Reagan was a racist, too. That's the line that we get. No, for real. No, this is the line that we get from the right. The left is saying, you know, this isn't an aberration. This is conservatism's apotheosis. Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Romney, McCain, they were all just as bad, and you're just as bad, too.
Yeah, there was this whole thing about how Reagan accepted the endorsement of the KKK in 1980, which is not true. But there are the foundational myths. The foundational myth is that the entire last 60 years of American life, or 50, half century of American life, is the Republican Party being racist. That, I mean, and if you want to go there, even if, you know, some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years put some meat on those bones a little bit in the way that it didn't before, but if you want to go there, that's how you got Trump.
It's clarifying.
That's how you got Trump, because if you walk around, if you're going to walk around saying Trump is a racist, here's my ultimate thing. I'm scared to say this, but what Trump did with the center back thing was not racist. It was xenophobic. Xenophobia used to be a pretty serious crime. It's no longer that serious a crime for some reason, because the only crimes are, you know, racism and white privilege. But saying you should go back where you came from is not racist. It's xenophobic. And so I bring this up only to say that if you want to remove the sting from a word and make it something that to go along to get along, all you're going to do is scare. All liberals are going to do is scare themselves, make themselves sick, make themselves hate the country, push their own party far to the left and help get Trump reelected. So this is what I'm saying. If they want to do that, that's where I look at Ilhan Omar and I say maybe she's working for Trump. You know, I mean, that some of this stuff, it is so patently obvious that all they need, you know, they need 88,000 votes in three states. And every step they take towards socialism, single payer, and the idea that if you are white, there's something wrong with you, these are ways to ensure that those 88,000 votes are not gotten. Hey, silence.
Well, I just want to say, I've been sitting here thinking about Christine's question about optimism among conservatives in the age of Trump and after Trump. And I'm trying to figure out to what extent there is a version of optimism among Trump supporters. There's a kind of triumphalism, which is not necessarily optimism, yeah. Right? Because optimism is optimism, I think, involves a degree of faith, and this yes. and there's none of that in Trumpism, right?
Right.
No, it's perpetual. It's perpetual war. And if you're winning, then you're winning. And if you're losing, you're losing. So I guess if you're winning, then you may not be optimistic, but right. you are what? I don't know. I mean, because you don't have to be hopeful if you're winning, because right. you're already winning or something like that. I don't know. I mean, the one thing you can say about the Trump voter versus the Democratic voter, right, is that a Trump voter is much more likely to be a religious person. Right, so religious faith contains within it an essential, you know, teleological, epistemological optimism. Mm-hmm. Right, that right. The best is yet to come. Whatever religion you're in, the best either in the afterlife or the coming of the Messiah or the return of the Messiah or whatever. And without that, you then have the techno pessimism of the. Of the left, which is, you know, we're about to, you know, basically New York is about to be hit by a tidal wave from the melting of the polar ice caps.
Right.
But they don't seem very optimistic.
No.
Anyway, what's interesting to me is that stuff like this goes on two more months and, you know, the every never Trumper, you know, who hasn't explicitly gone to the demo, what are they going to do? What if the Democratic Party is Elizabeth Warren, Ilhan Omar, and AOC?
Well, they're not optimistic either. the never Trumpers.
Well, anyway, so with that, we will bring this podcast to a blessed close. And Christine, we made it all the way through.
I know the Luddite curse did not fall on my head this time.
That's true. The weird thing about Christine is that she's a Luddite who's really good with technology. It's a very mysterious combination of skills. Anyway, so I hope everybody has a good weekend and isn't melted by the heat plague that we're experiencing here on the East Coast. For Christine Rosen, Abe Greenwald, and Nora Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.